Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job. Can someone
been humble.
And hello, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. And you are speaking with Cal Fritzy and Tim Burton. We are going to be discussing the West confronts the East. Before we delve into that, though, I would very much like to welcome the fellow host of the program, and that is Tim. And Tim, how are you today?
Well, good evening, Kel. I'm unbelievably fine. And how the devil are you tonight?
As usual, infidelity well.
I didn't know you were going to say that, Kel. That's a real laugh. Excuse me while I get my needle and cotton, because I do believe my sides have split. Anyway, carry on.
Oh, boy. Oh, I'm having quite a day. I think my cat is looking at me rather strange, because I was doing calisthenics earlier today, and she was like, "Mommy, like, what are you doing?" But, you know, I know this is no excuse. We should exercise every day of the year, but it's springtime, and it's been so cold in Canada that it's been impossible to get outside and really do anything. I don't ski. I used to cross country ski, and I don't do that sort of thing. But the warm weather is here, and I was on my bike in the basement to make sure that it was in cycle shape. And my cat is looking at me, going, "Oh my God, what is she doing?" And well, you know, there you go. Okay, enough about me. What did you do today?
Oh, I had a tremendous day. I had, as you know, I've been writing a few articles for an online magazine recently, and mm-hmm. I'm really getting into the swing of things there. And then I went down to my local leisure club in the afternoon, and I had an absolutely excellent time. They've got a tremendous. Some of your listeners might know it. It's called the Belfry, and it's in the centre of England, very close to Birmingham. Yeah. And people go there for golf tournaments and that. Well, I don't play golf, but what they do have there also is an excellent gym and swimming pool. And I try and get down there when I can to take advantage of it. So, you know, no matter what the weather, well, no matter if it's snowing or hailing outside, I can highly recommend something like that to get the old juices flowing, as it were. And it was certainly an excellent afternoon this afternoon. So thank you for asking.
Well, we have quite a program today, and it is entitled "The West Confronts the East." You had brought up a very, very prolific article, and this pertains to President Milos Zeman, and he made a statement this week, and he was speaking about the Islamic ideology for the Brussels Jewish Museum murders. And I found this rather fascinating. He was speaking about the capture in Marseilles on Friday, in fact, of a suspect whom French authorities said had fought with jihadists in Syria and may be tied to the May 24th murder of four people at the Jewish Museum of Belgium in central Brussels. My apologies. So I found that rather fascinating.
Well, yes. I mean, this is this is something we let's see. That the actual event that precipitated it all, which was the murder in Brussels of four people just outside the Jewish Museum. As I understand it, there were two staff and two tourists. I mean, that was pretty horrific. But when we found out there was a guy that was arrested in Marseille, as you say, in possession of what looked like, coincidentally, the same weapons that were used in the attack, although I suppose they'll have to wait for forensic evidence to actually prove it, it did seem to all tie together because, shock horror, it apparently turns out he was a Muslim. Who would have thought it? That was my first reaction. But yeah, the most interesting thing to have come out of that, or one of the most interesting things, is the comment that was made by the Czech president, Miloš Zeman. I probably not pronounce that correctly. My Czechoslovakian isn't quite on a par with all the other languages that I speak. tongue in cheek.
You mean you don't speak 14 languages? What's wrong with you?
Well, I probably know how to order a beer in a lot more than 14 languages, but I'm not fluent in any of them. So I suppose I ought to make that clear. But anyway, the Czech president, he actually said what no other Western leader, to my knowledge, has said before, which was that events like these, and he worded it quite carefully, he said events like these should not just be looked at as the result of rogue fundamentalists who have a religious grievance. He said the effectively, and I'm paraphrasing here, okay, he said the root cause of what we're seeing around the world with incidents like this is the Islamic ideology. He specifically, he made no bones about it. He didn't beat about the bush like all the other Western leaders that we know and love have been beating about the bush, well, certainly for as long back as I can remember. I mean, the most egregious example from last year that I can recall is our very own Prime Minister David Cameron, who stood up in Parliament just after the murder of Lee Rigby on May the 22nd last year and told an outraged British populace that it had nothing to do with Islam. Now, the good rule of thumb here, of course, in these cases is when a government spokesman stands up and says it has nothing to do with Islam, the one thing you can be sure about is that it has everything to do with Islam. So it was very refreshing to hear the Czech president say quite clearly and without beating about the bush that the root cause of incidents of this nature is the Islamic ideology. And he said, to be fair, he said, I would condemn any ideology that called for the mass murder of Arabs, he says, but I don't hear anybody calling for that. He says, what I do hear is calls on a regular basis for the mass murder of Jews. And the root cause, as he said, he could, I suppose, have gone into more detail and said, well, here are the verses in the Quran which call for either the murder of Jews or just generally anti-Semitic in nature. And there are, well, dozens if not hundreds of verses like that. I'm not going to bother reading them out on air right at this moment as we speak, unless anybody particularly wants me to do it, but there are dozens. And
I would like you to.
Oh, you would? Okay, fair enough. I'm going to see in that case what I can find as we're talking, because I actually, when I read this particular article about the Czech president, I thought, well, that's got to be worth following up, because the fact that he said something like that, it didn't seem to have been jumped on or picked on by the significance of it didn't seem to have been jumped on by a great many people. I mean, I looked at it and I thought, that's really significant, because no other Western leader up to now has actually had the courage to say that. And all right, you might say there's good reason for that, because people who stand up and say such things generally make themselves targets. And as we know, when Muslims are upset about things of this nature, they don't sit down and write a letter to The Guardian, as we as civilized people might. They get out on the street, they pick up sharp-bladed instruments, and they go around rioting and destroying things and killing people. That's the Islamic way. And so for a Western leader to come out and say something like this, I thought, must have taken great courage. And I would certainly commend his example to our other Western leaders. And one would hope that in the next few days or weeks to come, we would see more people putting their head above the parapet in the same way that Menos Zeman has done, and saying the unsayable. What has been up to now has been virtually unsayable by people in our political elites, that the root cause of all this chaos and mayhem that we are seeing emanating from the Islamic world, Muslims killing innocent people in the name of Islam, shouting Allah Akbar all the time as they're doing it, in the most cruel and horrific ways possible, with guns, knives, bombs, you name it, it is down to the Islamic ideology. And the Islamic ideology calls for the death and subjugation of non-Muslims, and Jews in particular. And I have actually got some Quran passages in front of me as we're talking. I'm going to drop... Can I get this and drop this? I'll see if I can actually drop this article into the chat rooms in a bit. But let's just take one or two examples of... examples here. Quran chapter 2. Verse 65, Quran chapter 2, verse 89. The famous one, of course, that most people will have heard of is Quran chapter 3, verse 110 to 112, which, paraphrased, says Muslims are the best of people and Jews are among the most accursed of people. When you, there are dozens of others, 3181, 551, there's another famous one, don't take Jews as friends and allies. I mean, to be fair, it says don't take Jews and Christians, you know, so it's spreading the hatred around, which is nice. Mm-hmm. So there are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of verses of this nature in the Quran telling Muslims to treat Jews... Jews in particular, harshly. It says Jews are accursed, they're cursed by Allah, and basically giving Muslims the idea that it's perfectly all right to kill Jews because they're somehow less than human. There's a verse in here somewhere about Allah turning Jews into apes. Yes, here we go, chapter 7, verse 166. I knew it was there somewhere. Jews are turned into apes. Quran chapter 9, verse 29. Now, I seem to have heard that somewhere before quite recently, which paraphrased basically says, fight and subjugate Jews and Christians. But when you have a plethora of verses like this in the Quran, it's hardly surprising that people who read the Quran and who take it seriously go out and act in this absolutely appalling and atrocious way. And when I say they take it seriously, Muslims are commanded, as I'm sure all our listeners know, to do just that. They have to take the Quran absolutely as the word of Allah relayed through the Islamic prophet Muhammad, and they are not allowed to question it. In fact, I think it's all chapter 5, verse 101-102, actually forbids Muslims from questioning the teachings in the Quran in any way, because to question it is, the word that encompasses it is shirk, and that's one of the worst sins. Disbelief is one of the worst sins that a Muslim can possibly do. If he's a if he's serious about what he's doing, if he's a professional Muslim, then he has to believe, and he has to believe 100%. And if you believe this kind of bollocks 100%, then your behaviour is likely to be affected accordingly. And of course, with many Muslims, that's exactly what happens. And they go out and they think it's absolutely fine to kill Jews, to kill Christians, to basically attack anybody and anything who is not Muslim or anything that or any belief system that is not Muslim. They think it's absolutely fine to do what they can to destroy that. And that includes non-Muslim civilizations like ours, of course. And we're dealing with the consequences of that. And our hands are shackled because our political leaders are not saying what the root cause is. They refuse to say. So it's absolutely a bright shaft of sunlight. It's a breath of fresh air when somebody like Milos Zeman, the Czech president, stands up and says what he does. So I'll throw the mic back to you, because I've given you a lot of points all in one go there, Kel. But I thought it was good to set the scene.
Tim, you do it so wonderfully. You know what? I just put down my microphone and sit back in my chair with my hands clasped around my head and just listen.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I've got those magic fingers. I know exactly what you mean.
There you go. But this is actually quite fascinating. People know that I am on a mission, and I'm trying to get a team together here in Canada and engage people in a global letter-writing campaign to get in touch with their politicians and demand that Islam be de-indexed as a political religious status and have it re-indexed. Phrased that wrong. Get Islam de-indexed as a religious status and have it re-indexed as a political status, because Islam is not a religion. We know that. And so when this article came across, and this is from the Times of Israel, and when the Milos Zeman said this, this was rather fascinating to me. And this is the president of the Czech Republic, and he blamed Islamist ideology for the Brussels Jewish Museum murders. Now, President Milos Zeman, he made this statement last week, and this was before the capture in Marseille on Friday, or... what's the date on this? Okay. Well, either way, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
President Milos Zeman, he made the statement last week before the capture in Marseille. Okay. Tim, here come those fake words again.
far away.
I love live radio.
Well, yeah.
Oh, this is terrible. This is not a...
So, I've got the Times of Israel article just coming up on my screen now. So I'm just having a look as we're talking. I'm running on my computer, which is a bit steam driven at the moment. I've had to wind up the clockwork key in the back, and I'm just getting this. I'm trying to scroll down here.
I've got it.
Nemush.
Nemush
is his name.
I am so embarrassed that I cannot pronounce that word. And you know, this is such an important topic, ladies and gentlemen. And I implore you to forgive me, because I am not well-versed in foreign pronunciation, and so I'm trying to read this.
I'll tell you what then, Kel. I'll read this paragraph if you like. I'm just reading from the Times of Israel. Have you dropped that into the chat room? I haven't looked at the chat room to see if that link has been dropped in. Okay, so the Times of Israel reported that on May the 30th, so that's what, 2 days ago, three, the French police in Marseille arrested a 29-year-old man who they identified as Mehdi Mehdi Nemush. I tell you what, you have to have a load of phlegm in the back of your throat when you're pronouncing these names. That's the trick behind it. Welsh is very similar, you know. Welsh and Arabic have got a lot to answer for. So plenty of phlegm in the back of your throat, and then it's much easier. So Mehdi Nemush is his name. Sources familiar with the investigation told the AFP news agency that he arrived in Marseille aboard a bus that passed through Brussels on its way from Amsterdam, and he had an AK-47 assault rifle and a handgun in his luggage, as you do when you go on holiday. It says on May the 24th, which was 6 days earlier, an unidentified shooter killed four people at the Jewish Museum of Belgium in central Brussels with a handgun and what appeared to be an AK-47. So call me old Mr. Cynical, if you will, but it seems that there may be a connection between this guy. I shouldn't laugh because it's a, you know, it's a horrific incident and I'm making fun of things. I shouldn't really do that. But
it's just so totally ironic.
Yeah, it is. It's completely, completely ironic. You would think that having carried out this crime, the last thing he'd be doing is travelling halfway across Europe with the murder weapons tucked in his suitcase. But there you go. Who can fathom people? Who can fathom Muslims these days? I mean, we do try sometimes at what makes Muslims tick, and I mean that's a subject for another day, because I've got some excellent articles here by a Danish criminal psychologist that looks at just those sort of things.
Yeah.
But I'm getting off topic, so we'll come back to this specific article. Nemush, who lives in a French border city close to Brussels, about 55 miles south of Brussels, so he's believed to have fought in Syria with the Jihadists last year, and he's being held on suspicion of murder and attempted murder. Well, I suppose that's something. He's travelled from Brussels, where the murders were committed, with what looks very suspiciously like similar armaments in his luggage, and he's being held on suspicion of murder, and quite rightly, Milos Zeman, the Czech president, has put his finger on the ideology behind this. I mean, there would have been a lot of people out there, I'm sure, who would be saying right at the start. In fact, I think only this week, Tariq Ramadan, a famous, a self-styled professor, who I think, I think he's a big noise in Oxford these days, Tariq Ramadan. He said that it was a good possibility that they were killed because of a personal grudge, nothing to do with Islam at all. I mean, and that's just the sort of thing that David Cameron might say. He said, you know, just because some Jews get murdered outside a Jewish museum in Brussels by somebody of Arab appearance carrying an AK-47, you shouldn't assume that Islam has anything to do with it. If it was only a one-off and there hadn't been 23,000 other fatal attacks carried out by Muslims in the name of Islam since 9/11, then I might be inclined to agree with him. But unfortunately, when you get patterns of this nature, it does tend to sort of lead you down the path to think, well, maybe there is a connection after all. And the more that you investigate the possibility of that connection, everything, when you suddenly realise that connection is there and you start looking for more evidence, whether it's evidence for or evidence against, then it all falls into place. So Milos Zeman, the Czech president, was quite right, in my view, in saying what he did. So he does say here, I know of no movement that calls for massive slaughter of Arabs, but I do know of a movement, an anti-civilization movement, he describes it, which I suppose is fair enough, that calls for massive extermination of the Jews. And there you have it. I mean, he's not wrong. In that last article that I was looking at before this one, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of verses listed from the Quran calling for the death and violence towards Jews to the point where extermination is not too much of a leap when you have a book that devotes a huge amount of its text to hatred, anti-Semitic hatred towards Jews, it's not a great leap of faith to suddenly find that there are Muslims out there who want to get rid of Jews altogether because they think that it will please Allah. And when I talk about a great deal of text, with the Quran, of course, what you have to realize is that 64% of the Quran is devoted not to making Muslims better people, not to developing spiritual enlightenment or a search for goodness, beauty, and truth, but purely to telling Muslims how they must treat non-Muslims, and that is usually in the most ruthless ways possible. 64%. And when you've got a book that is 64% political in that nature, it's not a big leap to say that the entire ideology is political, because the ideology is based in large part on the Quran, and it's also based on the Hadith and on the Sunnah, which is the Hadith and the Sirah, and they also, strangely enough, have a lot of text in there that calls for violence and murder against non-Muslims and Jews in particular. So to actually call it a political ideology, as I think it should be, and that's what you were talking about a little earlier, Kel, I think is a logical progression from the evidence available. Anyway, again, I've thrown a whole bunch of stuff in there all in one go, so I'm going to turn the microphone back to you now to pick a couple of bits out of that to develop a bit further.
I'm reading this article. I'm reading the quotations by this gentleman, the president of the Czech Republic, Milo Zeman. What he said, "I will not be reassured by claims that these are the actions of small fringe groups." And, of course, he said this at the Prague Hilton on May 26 about the shootings, which he called abominable acts of murder. He added, "I believe, by contrast, this is xenophobia, racism, or anti-Semitism, or at the very nature of this ideology on which these fanatical groups rely." And I found that particular quote, Tim, very fascinating, because he brings up the issue of xenophobia, racism, and anti-Semitism. Now, this is what you and I are accused of every day, 24/7, 365 days of the year. For this person to come out and say this on a world stage, and he pretty much verified everything that you and I as a collective have been talking about, and not just you and me, of course. I mean, we're talking about the Radio Jihad Network, EDL Radio. It is amazing that this person, a powerful person in the West, would come out and declare that it is actually Islam that are the xenophobics. They're the racists, and they're the anti-Semitisms.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is one of the things that Muslims routinely do when people like you and I criticize Islam as being the root cause behind everything we're seeing. They say that we are the haters. We are the ones who are guilty of xenophobia. We are the ones who are guilty of Islamophobia, racism, bigotry, hate mongering, all the other terms. What have I missed out? Oh, extreme right wing. But we'll leave that one aside for the moment and just concentrate on the other ones. We're guilty of all these things simply for pointing out the obvious based on the evidence which is available in front of our eyes. And When you're assessing things as we do, and I'm talking about you and me, Kel, and all the other people in the counter jihad movement, and all the people who listen to us on Blog Talk Radio, we don't just pick facts out of the air and make up conspiracy figures around a fantasy. We actually look at the evidence and we weigh it up, and if we think the evidence is leading us in a particular direction, then we look for things which confirm or deny how true that might be, and you build up a picture on that basis. I mean, that's all about what scientific method and reasoning is about. And we do this, if we've had a good classical Western education, we do this as a matter of routine, so that when we're presented with, let's say, for example, 23,000 fatal attacks since 9/11, we might say, well, that's, you know, that's really strange. What could have caused that? You know, is it, you know, an earthquake in Chile? Could it be a hurricane in the West Indies? Well, no. What do these things have in common? They were all committed by Muslims in the name of Islam. And it doesn't take a great deal more searching before you find that the thing that's driving Muslims to do these things in the name of Islam is in fact the Islamic ideology itself. The evidence is there. You've only got to read it with an open and unbiased mind to come to the conclusion that every sane person is capable of coming to. And that is the fact that the ideology is the root cause. And Muslims would have us deny the evidence of our own eyes and say that we're just Islamophobic or racist for pointing it out. They cast themselves as oppressed underdogs who deserve sympathy, and they play the victim at every opportunity in order to deny the plain truth, which is right in front of our eyes. And I think that it's testimony to the power of political correctness and multiculturalism that so many people have fallen for it, and particularly over the last 30 or 40 years, but fallen for it they have. And that's why I say that when you've got somebody like the Czech president, Milos Zeman, saying what he said, it's a bit like the little child in the story of the emperor's new clothes. He stands up and says, the emperor's got no clothes. You know, he speaks the truth that is plain to see to everybody, that nobody else wants to say. And that's why I'm hoping that this is going to be the start of a similar process where people say, you know what, that Czech president, he's absolutely right. Of course, you know, we knew it all along, really, but it needs somebody with the courage to actually stand up and say, you know, somebody prominent, you know, if you and I say it, we can be dismissed as racist Islamophobes, okay? But when the president of a Western country stands up and says such a thing, he has to be taken notice of. He can't be brushed under the carpet. And that's why this is so important. And he does go on to say, I mean, I don't know if you want to read the rest of that text out. I mean, I think what I'll do is turn the microphone back to you, Kel, because you were reading out that particular paragraph. And there are actually a couple of other paragraphs further down there, which are also quite important. So I'm going to turn the microphone back over to you to comment on what I've said and perhaps go on with that article.
Tim, you know what? There is so much of this article that we can dissect. I don't even know which paragraph I want to share. But okay. Believe me, this one. And we have to remind people that President Zeman, he is known for his support of Israel. And he was speaking at an event celebrating the 66th anniversary of Israel's independence. He offered his listeners proof of this assertion in a quote from Kitab al-Fitna wa Ashrat al-Sa'a, the 41st book of Sahih Muslim, which is one of the major texts of Sunni Islam. The stones and trees will say, O Muslim, O Abdullah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. And this is a verse right out of the Evil Green Book. Now, I was dissecting this article, like I say. There is a term called political correctness, President Zeman went on to say. And this term may be a euphemism for political cowardice. So let's not be cowardly. We should clearly name the enemy of human civilization. And this enemy is international terrorism coupled with religious fundamentalism and religious intolerance. This fanaticism does not focus on a single state, as we saw after 9/11. Muslim fanatics in Nigeria recently captured 200 young Christian girls. Well, it was a little higher than that. He goes on to say, I know of no movement that calls for massive slaughter of Arabs, but I do know of anti-civilization movement that calls for massive extermination of the Jews. He added this according to a transcription of his speech that was posted on May 27th on Zeman's official website. Tim, how do we dissect this?
Well, again, he's elaborating a little bit more. He's not just saying that it's Islamic ideology and stopping there. He's said proof of the assertion. He's quoted Kitab al-Fitan wa Ashrat as-Sa'ah, which is the 41st book of Sahih Muslim, which is actually one of the series of hadiths which are considered to be sound, because the thing about the hadith is that not all the hadiths are considered to be equally valid and equal. There are some hadiths which are considered to be more reliable than others, and it's quite common for Muslims to say, if somebody quotes a hadith, they'll say, oh yeah, but that hadith, it's not a proper hadith, it's a fake hadith, and it doesn't have the appropriate chain of transmission, which is an important thing when you're determining how reliable a hadith should be. And they'll try and pull the wool over your eyes that way. But Sahih Muslim is one of the most reliable and most highly recognized groups of hadith, and so when somebody quotes from that hadith, then you should take note. And when it's quite a famous quotation, the stones and trees will say, "Oh Muslims, there is a Jew behind me. Come and kill him." And Muslims take that as license to kill Jews. There is no question about that. Muslims consider that they have a divine license to kill a Jew, and there are plenty of Muslims out there who think that one of the ways to paradise is to kill a Jew, and then their place in paradise is assured. And they do this every day if they have the opportunity. I'm not even going to get into specific examples now, except to say they occur in every country in the West. It's not confined to the Middle East. You'll get some Muslim that has the opportunity. He'll spot a Jew in the street. And this is happening more and more frequently now in Western countries. And Jews, if they're wearing recognizable symbols of their faith in the street, are likely to be attacked. Now, all right. You might say, well, it serves them right for wearing recognizable symbols of their faith. But that is not the approach we should be taking. We should be saying that in a Western country, in Western democracies, there is no place for people who think that they can go around attacking Jews because of recognizable symbols of their faith. They should be... We shouldn't be even countenancing it, far less trying to explain it away by saying, oh, well, you know, that's what Muslims believe. Well, if that's what Muslims believe, then they can get out of our country and go and believe it somewhere else. We don't have to have these people here. They contribute on balance, and there's a negative contribution from Muslims to pretty much every Western democracy in terms of, all right, you might have the occasional Muslim who does good work as, let's say, a doctor or a brain surgeon or something like that. And I'm sure plenty of people can think of similar arguments. And there are plenty of people who will say, but I know Muslims and they're nice people. Oh, well, all well and good. But that doesn't alter the fact that the ideology to which they subscribe is profoundly anti-humanity. And if we continue to put up with it in our civilizations, we're going to doom our children and grandchildren to lives of absolute misery as they try and fight off an increasing swarm of Muslims who, you know, they breed like rabbits for a start. And when they get to a sufficient population percentage, they will wage outright civil war on the rest of us. They will do that. And I'm not picking examples at random. You only have to look at Tears of Jihad, Google Tears of Jihad, to see that that is a pattern throughout Islamic history. That is what they do. The only thing that Islam is good for is making more Islam. It has no inherent benefit whatsoever. And we can rightly call it the enemy of human civilization, as Milos Zeman actually said in that paragraph. He said we should clearly name the enemy of human civilization, and the enemy is international terrorism coupled with religious fundamentalism and religious intolerance. And he's specifically referring to Islamic ideology, which he talked about in an earlier paragraph. We really need to take it on board that Milos Zeman is not making these things up. He's not just being racist and Islamophobic and bigoted. And I don't suppose he's even a member of the EDL. He's a president of a Western country, and he's speaking clearly and in terms which need to be said over and over again until everybody who's not a Muslim in our Western countries takes it on board and realizes that Islam is an evil that we can well do without in our Western civilization. Anyway, I'll pass the microphone back to you, Kel. I stopped rather suddenly there, so I'll give you a chance to collect.
That's absolutely fine, because we have gone through the issue of the political correctness and everything else, and see, the world is not paying attention, and that there is a very dire threat in the West, and this is called political Islam. They're capable of devastation, in that if they can hijack four airliners and dive them into American buildings and institutions, and they can hijack trains, and they can create devastation in the UK, i.e. 7/7. And when I referred to trains, I meant Spain, of course. But you know what? This is every day. This goes on every single day, ladies and gentlemen. And the latest atrocity, of course, that comes to light is the kidnapping of over 200 young Christian girls in Nigeria. If we're not paying attention to that, I don't know. Are we asleep at the switch? What about the issue of a man who kills his wife and he's getting a lighter sentence because it's called being part of a culture? What about that young bride that is being threatened to death? Threatened to death, because she's threatened with death, because she's already in captivity. Like, what on earth are we to do with this? And I want to bring up this paragraph, and that is, we are staying with the theme of Czech President Milos Zeman. Now, he has gone on to say, on May 30th, French police in Marseille arrested a 29-year-old man whom they identified as Mehdi Nemerouch. Sources familiar with the investigation told the AFP news agency he arrived in Marseille aboard a bus that passed through Brussels on its way from Amsterdam and had an AK-47 assault rifle and a handgun in his luggage. On May 24th, On May 24th, an unidentified shooter killed four people at the Jewish Museum of Belgium in central Brussels with a handgun and what appears to be an AK-47. 47. Tim, I don't know what to do with these people.
Well, once they have committed the crime, then all you can do with the individuals is track them down and make sure that it gets widely publicised that when they do get caught for committing crimes like this, then they receive the most heavy punishments available. What we're seeing at the moment, of course, is that when Muslims commit crimes of this nature, they frequently, as you said, get lighter sentences or lighter punishments because dhimmi judges in the West say to themselves, well, we shouldn't be passing judgment so harshly because after all it's in their culture. But I don't think that's any excuse at all. The fact that it's in their culture is neither here nor there. We have laws for a reason, and that is that we can, within a structure of laws, we can develop a society which can progress and advance the cause of humanity. That's the whole purpose of having laws. If we didn't have the laws that we do, and everybody was just out for whatever they could get for themselves, and the whole Western civilization went back to, well, I don't know, I hesitate to use the term the Wild West, but it's perhaps not the best example, but what I'm trying to get at is if you don't have a system of laws, it's very difficult for anybody to advance the cause of humanity because you're having to watch your back the whole time because your next door neighbor or somebody will feel himself free to do whatever he wants, and that might include doing something harmful to you to further his aims. That's no way to live your life. All right, some people might find it quite exciting, but most people don't. Most people would like to live their peaceful lives in a stable structure that is controlled by laws, and to have lawmakers and politicians and governments, if you like, who enforce those laws fairly and equitably and without fear or favour. And when you start getting judges who say, well, we're not going to punish this guy as much because it's his culture, it sends out completely the wrong message. And if we want our societies to develop fairly and justly and equitably for everybody, then we have to treat them the same under the law. The law is so important. A lot of people say, oh, the law is an ass. I mean, that's a famous phrase. Or the law has some obvious anomalies, which I'm sure it does, because in most countries, the law is a very complex thing. And there will be anomalies, and there will be times when it seems that the law is an ass. But nevertheless, we should all of us support it. Every one of us should support it. And we should encourage, if not actually demand, that the people who are in charge of enforcing the law do so without fear or favour. And when judges come along and say that culture had a bearing on this crime, so we're going to give him a slap on the wrist instead of throwing him behind bars and throwing away the key, it sends out, as I say, it sends out entirely the wrong signal. So one of the things we should be doing is saying, whenever we have examples of this, that we treat them with the same seriousness as we would any other crime. But we also look at the root cause, which is the ideology. And the reason we do that is because if we continue to treat every one of these crimes as just being individuals committing crimes and there's no common thread, we're never going to solve the problem. I mean, ultimately, what we want to do is to solve the problem of Muslims running around in our societies, causing mayhem and chaos at every opportunity. And we're not solving it by pretending that the ideology does not exist or that it doesn't have anything to do with what Muslims are doing. A good analogy, which I like to use, is, let's say, during World War II, okay, and you're on a street somewhere in Europe, and you get a German soldier coming down the road with a gun, and the German soldier, I don't know, he might kill somebody with his gun. All right, so he's what we do. We don't go after the Nazi ideology that is behind the reason that he's there on the streets in the first place. We just focus on that soldier and we prosecute him in a criminal court, you know, and he gets 5 years for killing somebody with a gun or whatever the punishment is. And that's what I mean about looking at the bigger picture and saying, how are we going to solve the problem? The problem of the Nazi ideology was solved by us naming the enemy and going all out to crush that ideology no matter what it took. And we did that successfully. And if we had not done it, the world, in my view, would have been a far worse place than it is now. And we need to do exactly the same thing with Islam. Islam is an ideology that is profoundly anti-humanity, and it needs to be totally crushed. There is no point just going after the individuals who commit the crimes, although that is an important part of it. You have to go after the ideology. You name it as being profoundly anti-civilization and anti-humanity. You name it as being a political ideology, not a religion, and you go after it with every resource at your disposal until it is entirely crushed and the world is free of it. Now, it's a much bigger job to do that, of course, because there are Muslims all over the world. It's not just a question of a few million Nazis in Germany, that you all in one convenient location that you can easily attack. It's much more difficult to crush something like Islam. But nevertheless, if we want humanity to advance, crush it is what we're going to have to do. We may not be able to get rid of every single Muslim, and that may not that in my view shouldn't be the goal. The goal should be to take away the teeth that Islam has so that it is no longer able to threaten our civilization in the way that it is doing at the moment. And once we have constrained it and controlled it and we have crushed its ability to threaten our civilization, well, maybe we can take a deep breath and look at where we might go from there. But first of all, we have to deal with what is under our noses, and what is under our noses will destroy us if we do not name the enemy and act accordingly. And I'm going to pass the microphone back to you, Kel, for the moment.
And thank you, Tim, very much for that, because I can't even refute anything you said in that statement. You are, I never refute anything you say anyway.
Well, I mean, there may be times every now and again when I'll say something, and if I'm working with any kind of incorrect statement, I'd be very happy for anybody who's listening closely in the chat room to sort of pop up and say, "Oi, Tim," and to offer up a correction. I never have a problem with that. I never pretend I know everything, and I don't think we should, because this is a complex subject, and there are all sorts of ramifications. But nevertheless, there are some things that stand out. And when it comes to Islam, the one thing that stands out is that it is a clear and present danger to our civilization. And we are not dealing with it because of political correctness and multiculturalism, which is preventing our political leaders from calling it what it is and taking the appropriate steps. And we need to be standing on street corners and shouting it out at every opportunity. So by all means, please, Kel, if you think of something, or if our listeners think of something that is relevant that I haven't covered, or that I've covered, or I've covered incorrectly, please speak out. I don't pretend to be infallible on these things. Anyway, back to you with that, Kel.
I think we're at the top of the hour, and what we're going to do is take our song break. After that, we're going to come back, and we are going to get a little more esoteric about the issue of demanding our Western leaders to speak out about the issue of political Islam. But we're going to play this song, Tim, and this is Hallelujah, and this is from the Jewish perspective.
Okay.
And we'll see everybody back here in 3.5 moments.
Hallelujah, love.
And welcome back, everybody. And you are listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. And today we are talking about the West confronts the East. The first hour, we were concentrating on President Milo Zeman and his statement that he made last week before the capture in Marseille on Friday of a suspect whom French authorities said had fought with jihadists in Syria and may be tied to the May 24th murder of four people at the Jewish Museum of Belgium in central Brussels. We want to thank everybody that is joining us. We want to thank people that are in our chat room. We are so grateful that you're taking time out of your busy day to spend with ours, and that includes Agador and Bigfoot and Kath, Luchadora, Moving Forward, Paul Alexander, and Vito Esposito. And thank you, Agador. Yes, that is a beautiful song. That is the Jewish rendition of Hallelujah. My apologies. And Tim, welcome back. We are moving into new territory right now. I want to get a little more esoteric about how we can demand our governments to acknowledge this entity called Islam.
Yeah, one of the things we really must do is to get them to acknowledge it in terms that reflect reality. At the moment, what our governments are doing is they're saying, well, yeah, Islam, as everybody knows, is a benign and tolerant religion of peace. Furthermore, it is totally compatible with Western civilization and our cherished notions of parliamentary democracy, and is absolutely nothing to worry about. And the only problem is that this official version of Islam is a complete fiction. It's a lie, ladies and gentlemen. It is not true. And we have to bring that home to everybody so that they, when our governments come out with statements like this, we all stand up in metaphorically speaking, in collective outrage and say, we're not taking those lies anymore. It's only got as far as it has because the lie of official Islam has been sold. It's been sold quite cleverly, I suppose, we have to say, and that's come about because generations of Muslims have said to generations of non-Muslims, yep, Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace, and you need to be promoting it in that way. And in our eagerness to be tolerant and seem to be open-minded and multicultural and so on, we have taken what Muslims have said about Islam at face value and we've propagated that as if it were the truth. And the only trouble is, of course, that Muslims lie to us. Well, who would have thought it? But there you go. That's taqiyya for you. Muslims lie to us in order to pull the wool over our eyes when it comes to Islam. And our political elites have swallowed it, and they've pushed that official version to us all to stand up and say, well, it isn't true. It is a complete lie. And if you, as governments, continue to push that official version forward, devising policies, domestic and foreign policies, as you go, that are based on a lie, based on a fantasy, we're all going to be worse off in the long run. Far better, I would suggest, to base government policies, domestic and foreign, on reality rather than fantasy. And therefore, we demand that you speak the truth about Islam in every way, shape or form. Whenever you're talking about Islam to the rest of us, we want you to tell the truth about it. And there's a saying, of course, that I'm sure everybody's familiar with, is that tell the truth and shame the devil. And The significance behind that is it may cost you something to tell the truth. That you know, this is not a pain-free operation that we're about to undertake here. It is going to cost us something. To tell the truth is going to upset Muslim sensitivities. And as I said before, when Muslim sensitivities are upset, they don't just sit down and write a letter to their local newspaper. They pick up sharp-bladed instruments, go out on the streets, and cause rioting and mayhem and destroying property and killing people. And that is going to have to be dealt with. We cannot allow Muslims to continue with the lie that is official Islam that's being pushed forward, because that lie is actually serving as a vehicle to destroy our own civilization. And our own civilization is built on freedoms which our forefathers and ancestors handed down to us. We do not have the right to give those freedoms away. Our political elites do not have the right to give those freedoms away. And we have to stand up and say, we demand that you recognize Islam for what it is. It's not a religion. It's a political ideology. We can give all the reasons why it's a political ideology rather than a religion. It should not enjoy the religious privileges that it currently does. And it needs to be put into a category where everybody recognizes that to be the case. And then we can deal with it appropriately in the same way that we dealt with the Nazi ideology. We recognized that as a threat to humanity, a threat to civilization. And we categorized it as such. And we dealt with it. It wasn't a pain-free thing. Even back then, 70, 80 years ago, it took 55 million lives over the course of 6 years in World War II in order to thoroughly defeat that ideology. Okay, there were, I'm simplifying things because it was a world war and there were other factors besides Nazism involved. But nevertheless, that was a huge, huge factor in driving World War II, and the ideology needed to be defeated. And it was defeated, but there was a huge cost. But I still believe, 70, 80 years on, that cost was a cost worth paying, because what are we all here for if not to help our fellow man, to advance humanity, to develop a structure where people can live safely and in peace and generally promote the greatest good for the greatest number. I believe that our civilization, as it's currently set up, goes a long way towards doing that, and I think our civilization is worth protecting. And there are far too many people out there in our political elites who either don't believe that or don't think it's important. And we have to take them by the throat, metaphorically speaking, and rattle them until their teeth fall out and say, we are not accepting the official version of Islam. We want you to promote the truth, and we want you to devise domestic and foreign policies that reflect the truth, and we are not going to stand around doing nothing while you go and do something that is the complete opposite. Anyway, that's my view, and I'm going to pass the microphone back to you, Kel.
And it's interesting. I'm just going to go off on a sidebar here, Tim, and I like what you said about the Muslims. Reading a book by Dr. Bill Warner, Sharia Law for Non-Muslims, and it's a very slim volume, and people, I encourage you to order it on Amazon. And I liked what he said in one of his YouTube videos, in that they're Mohammedans. They're not Muslims, they're Mohammedans.
Well, Mohammedans is actually a far better term in my view, because Muslims are the followers of the Islamic prophet Muhammad. For some reason, Muslims don't actually like being called Mohammedans.
They can't stand it.
But it is actually a far better reflection of what they're all about. They follow the example of the Prophet Muhammad, and a professional Muslim should follow the example of the Prophet Muhammad in all respects. And as an aside, Kel, I use the word professional Muslim rather than devout Muslim, because
run with that, please. That's perfect.
If somebody is devout, it indicates that the meaning of that word indicates that the primary thing that's driving them is typically a religious drive. But because Islam is not first and foremost a religion, it's first and foremost a political ideology, I think it's fair to call Muslims who take Islam seriously professional Muslims, because they're dealing with Islam in a professional way, and they're taking it all completely seriously, and they're acting on the professional Mohammedans, even better. They're acting on the example of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, and they're taking it completely seriously. They're saying to themselves, I must not question anything that is in the Quran, anything that is in the Hadith, the Sirah, well, taken together, that's the Quran and the Sunnah. I have to take it completely seriously, and when it tells me that I have to hate Jews and Christians, I cannot be their friends, I must do everything I can to advance Islam, I must destroy anything that gets in the way of advancing Islam, I must generally live my life in order to make more Islam, whatever I do and in whatever way I can, professional about things. And I think if we were to call them professional Mohammedans rather than devout Muslims, that's actually a much more descriptive term that reflects reality. And if we're on the theme of reflecting reality, which I think we should be, then I think that's not a bad place to start. So yes, professional Mohammedans.
And I think that you should copyright that. You'll make millions, I say.
Well, maybe. But I think it's far more important. I mean, not that I wouldn't like to make millions, who wouldn't? But I mean, I think it's far more important that we hand down to our children and grandchildren a legacy which basically says we did everything we can to fight against this scourge which threatened to overrun our civilization and completely destroy our way of life. And if calling what were previously known as devout Muslims by the new mnemonic of professional Mohammedans, if that goes some way towards achieving that goal, then I will happily donate that free of charge. I won't put my copyright on it at all. That's something for everybody.
Well, you know, that's the thing, and this is what we have to ensure the populace. This is why we do these shows, and that is like when you read books by Dr. Bill Warner and Dr. Pastor Terry Jones, it is important that you self-educate. Tim and myself on our FB program, we are here to give you facts and figures and the tools to self-educate. But you really do have to get out there. You have to read these books. Tim, you won't even believe what's on my desk behind me, and it's unbelievable. Like you, reading books, Raising a Jihad Generation by Dr. John. He's not a doctor. My apologies, by John Guandolo. It is. There are people out there, people. There are people out there and trying to educate you about what is going on within the realm of Islam, and it's reaching your shores. One thing Tim and I are concentrating on today, though, is how can you engage your government? I have been all over the map about this for about a year now, and I'm actually working on getting a team together to concentrate on telling our government, we're sick of Islam. We've had it. We've had enough. And we want our respective governments to put, in Canada, it would be called a private member's bill, and that we can get one politician to stand up and say, look, Islam is not a religion, de-index it, and declare it a political entity and ban it. Right, Tim?
Well, yes. I mean, exactly how that might be best accomplished is going to be a question which could take up a whole show on its own. By all means, I would say if you can petition your local MP or your local political representative, either by letter or in person if they hold regular constituencies, What it needs is for a large number of people to actually do this. If only one or two people do it, nothing will get done. But if you can make your feelings plain in large numbers to your political representatives, they are going to have to, at some point, they are going to have to say, hey, there's an awful lot of people who think that this is important. Maybe I should be raising it at a higher level in national politics rather than just discussing it at local level. But it does require volumes of people to do this. One or two people doing it isn't enough. Now, exactly how that might best be done is going to depend on what your local political structure is like, who you can actually galvanise and get together to lobby your political representatives. How best that's done is going to vary from place to place. I certainly think that if you ever have an opportunity to talk to your local representative one-on-one, and you are knowledgeable in the way that we are knowledgeable on these shows, and get him to listen to you and to be able to explain what it is about Islam leads us to the conclusions that we do. That's a good way, but it requires an MP that listens. It requires somebody who's persuasive at talking, and an opportunity when they can both get together at a time when each of them has 5-10 minutes to spare to actually discuss these things. If you can't talk to your local MP on a level one to one, then emails may help. Personal letters written to them, hard copy, like, you know, in the way that we always used to do before the internet and email came along. I mean, that's going to be impressive, because a lot of people look at emails and they think, oh, I'll just click on that and it can go straight in the bin. But when people are writing letters, it's more difficult to ignore them. I'm not saying it's impossible to ignore them, but people are still... They still take more notice of letters than they do of emails these days, and you can certainly write to them. But the trick is to get not just one or two, but thousands of people writing to or emailing or trying to contact in whatever way with their local representatives at local level, and get all our representatives to realise that we think this is an important issue. It does take a certain amount of grassroots organising, and sadly, there seems to be no shortage of people on the left of the political spectrum who are happy to get involved with organising at grassroots level. But the people who really need to do it, the people with common sense on the right, on the centre, I should say, which has been designated these days as the extreme right, but it's actually the political centre. Those people seem to find it much harder to galvanise like-minded people into action and to lobby representatives in that way. But nevertheless, we are going to have to do it if we're going to achieve what we want to achieve peacefully. I mean, that's the trick. What we really want to do by calling for reindexing of Islam as a political ideology rather than a religion is we're trying to peacefully persuade our political representatives to take a certain course of action and move away from the path that is going to lead us down to chaos and civil war. I don't want to see blood on the streets. I'm sure you don't, Kel, and I'm sure our listeners in the chat room and all the other people we talk to on Blog Talk Radio and all the other counter-jihad presenters and so on, nobody wants blood on the streets. But if our political representatives will not listen to us, we see quite clearly what is going to happen if things are allowed to proceed in the way that they have been allowed to proceed for the last 20 or 30 years. And we will have civil war. It will be amongst us. It will be on our streets. I hate to be too melodramatic about this, but I'm reminded of a scene with Mel Gibson in a film called The Patriot, and it was set during some early part of American history, I think, not long
1800.
After around about 1800, yeah, and Mel Gibson stood up and gave a very eloquent speech in that film and said, the war, if we don't resolve this, the war will be amongst us. It will be fought amongst us on our streets. And that, of course, is what came to pass. And we're going to see exactly the same thing here in all our Western democracies. If Muslims are allowed to become more emboldened and more, if their population increases at the rate that it has been increasing, and nothing is done to constrain or control the Muslim percentage population, and they continue to become emboldened, we will see civil war amongst us on our streets. There is no question about that. History, you know, history is a good guide. And we have to do something about it. And I would far rather we did it peacefully. And I suppose I'm straying away, Kel, from what you were saying before about the best way to convince our political elites. But I think we have to start at local level and just let them know that we're serious about this. And I'll pass it back to you.
You know, I love that movie, The Patriot. What he said is absolutely phenomenal, and that he portrayed a very fine American colonial, and that was during the Revolutionary War, and his speech was absolutely phenomenal, and when he delivered that speech, it was during the battle. It was set in the battlefields, and he had a lot to say about that. I'm speaking off the top of my head because you just triggered something in me, Tim. Like, it's just amazing. I have something here, though, that I think.
Perhaps you understand. When I have a family of my.
Okay, I'm listening.
I have long feared that my sins would return to visit me. And the cost is more than I can bear. A past he wanted to forget. I've been to war, and I have no desire to do so again. I have 7 children. I do not wish to leave them fatherless. A family threatened by war. We have to do something.
I forbid you to go!
Not a child! You're my son!
A son fighting for his beliefs.
Father, I thought you were a man of principle.
When you have a family of your own, perhaps you'll understand.
When I have a family of my own, I won't hide behind them.
Hang him, put his body on display.
Colonel, I beg you, by the rules of war.
You're like a Nathan, sir, in the rules of war.
Or perhaps your children will.
You kind of know who they were fighting, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I just put a comment in the chat room to say it's a great movie because there are so many lessons for us. There's so many parallels with today. All right, there are differences, obviously, but we are faced with something that is going to have far-reaching repercussions, and our politicians are refusing to listen to what we're saying. And I suppose, you know, back then in 1800, they were fighting, the Americans were fighting against the dictatorial rule of King George. And, of course, the British were doing everything they could to try and stop the Americans breaking away. And, you know, it was a pretty rough time. If you happened to be living at that time, you probably would have seen, you know, terrible, terrible things, and they would have affected you personally. I would hope that we could, you know, move on as civilized people today, 200 years on, and say, let's resolve this in a fashion which is going to cause the least amount of bloodshed. But I really am afraid that if our politicians do not listen to us, that history is destined to repeat itself. And that's why it's important that we watch things like this, because history is one of those things that we can learn so much from if only we open our eyes and open our ears and listen to it and listen to what it's telling us. And it's in our political elites seem to be doing everything that they can to stop us learning from history. They refuse to learn from it themselves, and they want us not to learn from it either. They want us to think that everything that's happening today comes out of nowhere, and that it doesn't have a cause and it cannot be solved. We just have to put up with it. Well, I've got news for everybody. We don't have to put up with it. We can do something about this. There will be personal sacrifices involved if we decide to do this. It isn't going to be a painless thing, but it's going to be a lot more painless than leaving things to politicians as we are at the moment. And they are, quite frankly, they are not doing the job that it says on the tin. We are employing them effectively to look after our interests, to make domestic and foreign policy based on reality. That's the very least we can expect. And we expect them to, in exchange for all the taxes that they take from us, we expect them to provide us with a peaceful, stable society. And it's not just a question of getting the rubbish bins emptied once a week. It's having a stable society that represents a good framework for the advancement of humanity. This is what we expect from our government. This is why, as I said, going back right to the start of the show, why we have laws. Why do we have laws at all? So that we can provide a structure where we can develop and reach our full potential. We can't do that if everywhere around us is chaos. And at the moment, the forces of chaos are threatening to overrun the forces of civilization. Now, okay, you might say that the whole of humanity is all about a battle between good and evil, but we are on the side of good, and we need to recognize the value of what we have, and we need to defend it. We cannot just expect politicians to do it for us. If they refuse to do it for us, then there comes a time when we have to stand up, spit on our hands, and I think, as a famous philosopher once said, we have to hoist the black flag of the pirate's black flag, that is, not the black flag of jihad, and we have to go out and we have to get things done ourselves. Well, I'm hoping that we're only going to have to do this in metaphorical terms, and that our powers of persuasion are enough to persuade our politicians to change course. At the moment, I'm not very hopeful, but we have to try. We have to do what we can, because the alternative is unthinkable. Anyway, back to you, Carol. And
that clip I played, The Patriot, that was from the 18th century, and that was very powerful. People were standing up for their countries. Well, country. The Americans were standing up for their country, I should say. My apologies, people. And when that took place, that was bloody. That was a bloody war. But England has also been renowned for standing up for her country, and that was during the Nazi era and the Second World War. I always say, if it weren't for England and Canada, in the United States, if it weren't for us acting as a cohesion, we would, back then, we would be speaking German. Today, we are facing a threat, ladies and gentlemen, and that is called Islam. Islam is amongst us. It walks amongst us. It kind of reminds me of a movie that I watched once too, Tim, and it's called Tremors, and they're like big giant worms underground, and you're living in your little small town, and you're getting on with life. Each and every day, you're going to work, you're doing this, you're doing that, but there are tremors, and they're underground, and they're big, giant worms that crawl up and eat you alive. That is Islam to me, Tim. And when I speak about engaging our politicians, I don't know if they're going to listen to us. This is what worries me.
Well, I share your misgivings, I have to say. I don't know if they're going to listen to us at all. I think if enough of us stand up, then yes, they will listen to us. But the getting enough people to actually stand up and metaphorically speaking, thump on their desks and take them by the throat and rattle them till their teeth fall out, I don't know if we're going to get enough people in the time that's open to us to actually do it. We have to do it if we're going to spare our children and our grandchildren the Civil War scenario, which I outlined to you a few moments ago. We have to do it for their sake, if not for ourselves. You know, I think that, you know, whatever happens, people like you and me are going to be spared the worst of it, but our children won't be spared and our grandchildren won't be spared. And if we don't do everything in our power right now, while we can, while we still have breath in our bodies, they're going to curse us for it, and rightly so. Because, you know, we're in a position where we can do something, and we owe it to future generations to take those steps right now. There's no time to be lost, and we have to do it for our children and grandchildren.
Well, you know, if we don't take responsibility right now, there will be civil war. Now, when we talk about civil war all the time, and people don't quite understand exactly the ramifications behind that. When we speak about civil war, we are talking about the populace standing up against the government. But the issue will be Islam, right, Tim? And
well, yes.
People get confused by this. They get confused because they're not quite sure where the civil war will set upon. Will it be Muslims and the indigenous English in the streets? Or will it be the indigenous English against the government over the issue of Islam?
Well, I think that if politicians do not take note of what we're saying, then I think our only course of action is going to be to rise up against the government. And that might sound like it almost might sound like sedition when I say that. But as John F. Kennedy said 50-odd years ago, those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. And so if politicians will not listen to what we want, we don't really have much of an alternative. I mean, will it be Muslims on the streets against us, or will it be us against the government? Well, history takes funny turns, and I don't know that I would want to make a prediction about how it will start, but I can tell you that how it will develop as it goes along. And if you want a good example, I'd say one of the closest examples I could possibly give you in recent memory is that of Lebanon. Now, Lebanon used to be in living memory, a majority Christian country. And when Muslims became a greater percentage of the population in Lebanon, they started to flex their muscles. They started to assert themselves in the way that they do wherever they go, to demand that everybody conforms to their way of doing things, and to terrorize and intimidate everybody else to the point where they either fled the country or tacitly submitted to living under Muslim terror and intimidation, because that's what Muslims do. There's no sense of negotiation, of tolerance or compromise when it comes to relationships between Muslims and non-Muslims. There is just Muslims saying, this is what you're going to do, and there's just the rest of us doing it, because if we don't, we'll be faced with physical violence, intimidation and terror. And that's just the Muslim way of doing things. It's no way to conduct a civilized society, which is why I say there is no place for Islam in a civilized society. It has to be relegated to the margins of civilized society, or if we don't get Islam out of our civilization, we're all going to be the poorer for it. So we have to, as I say, we have to do what we can. Otherwise, I see things going down the way that Lebanon went. Lebanon was a majority Christian country. I won't say it was entirely peaceful, but Christians and Muslims did live side by side there for a long period of time. But when Muslims increased their percentage population, civil war resulted, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, were killed or displaced. We can expect to see that in Western countries. We can probably expect to see it in countries which have a larger Muslim population first and foremost, places like France, Holland, Sweden, for example, are probably going to see the effects of this sooner than we are in the UK, and certainly sooner than you will in the United States and Canada. But it is coming, because the Muslim demographic, which is to say the rate at which Muslims reproduce, is far greater than the demographics of the indigenous population. And while it might not seem to be making much of a difference today or tomorrow or next week, in a generation's time, or in two generations' time, there will be, proportionately speaking, a huge percentage increase in the number of Muslims compared to the rest of us. And that's when the trouble is really going to become apparent. So, yeah, we're going to see civil war if nothing happens. And Lebanon's a good place to start looking. Syria also, again, a country which was largely Christian and is now in the throes of civil war. When it finishes, you can bet that no matter what the outcome, there won't be a great number of Christians living there. They will have fled, and it will take generations before they return, if they return at all. Because, you know, nobody voluntarily wants to put themselves in a position where they're at odds with their neighbours, except Muslims, of course. Muslims do that as a matter of course. They make such bad neighbours wherever they go. It's routine for Muslims to intimidate and to instill terror into their neighbours and to either cow them into submission or cause them to flee. That's just the Muslim way of doing things. So, but for the rest of us, life is too short to get on badly with your neighbours, and so you move away. You know, if you can, you just leave. And that's why Muslim areas become 100%. Well, of course it isn't right. But that's why Muslim areas become 100% Muslim very, very quickly, because they make such bad neighbours, and they just intimidate everybody else into leaving. And we're seeing that now in our towns and cities in the UK and in other Western democracies. You see whole enclaves which are 100% Muslim, and the reason they're is because Muslims make bad neighbours. They make terrible neighbours.
Yeah, totally incompatible with the West. I don't think that we have to beat that dead horse here on RSD.
You're absolutely right, Kel. We probably don't, and I'm sorry if I went a little bit over the top.
No. What I'm saying is that I was going to expand on that, and I stopped myself because you brought up quite a wonderful and salient point, and that just reminded people that when the Muslims move in, thus the rest of us go. And in Canada, we call that white flight. And that's
it's the same over here. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Tim, we cannot tolerate that. And like, we can't tolerate this enclave mentality taking over our very fine neighborhoods and driving us out of our very homes. We have situations where that lady who has lived in her marriage home for 50 years and the Muslims want to buy her home because they want to buy the other house and the other house and the other house and the other house on the street, and they intimidate her into a situation so bad that she leaves. This is unfair. This is Islam. This is what they do. They move into your neighborhood and they drive you out. And this is unforgivable in what they do to the indigenous people in England. I am unbelievably shocked when I read stories. I open up a national daily, and this is even making news in the mainstream media. This is, I'm shocked what's going on in England and in Canada and in the United States and in Australia. This is unbelievable. They move in, they set up shop. And what happens is that they build a mosque. And you know what happens. When they build a mosque, they will come. And they will come in droves. And they will snap up the real estate. And they will drive you out of your very home. They send you up north. They will send you down east. They will get you out, and they will establish an enclave. This is shocking. This should very much be shocking to you as well. We have to stop this. It's mass Islamity, Jeff. And
it certainly is.
And Vito and Paul. Okay, I'm going to try to save myself here because I was just saying hello to Jeff.
Yeah, I understand. Well, you're right. I mean, the phrase that we like to use, of course, is it's mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. And that's a really good phrase to keep in mind. I mean, you describe it as shocking. I mean, I would say when you're setting it against normal, decent, civilized standards, it is shocking. But for Muslims, of course, it isn't shocking at all, because it's what works for Islam. It's worked for 1,400 years. They'll move into an area and they'll make life so miserable for anybody who doesn't want to do things the Islamic way that they will just leave. There are a few people who, of course, make the decision not to leave, but then for a quiet life they will either convert to Islam or they will become dhimmis in the professional sense, living as third class mm-hmm. citizens and paying the jizya. Some people will do that because it's the least of all the evils at their disposal, but for most people, if they can get out, they do get out, because life is too short to live next to Muslims when they behave in such an unpleasant manner. But they do that because it has worked for them. It's like bullies all over the world. They do what works for them. And the only thing that stops a bully is if you stand up to them. There's no amount of reasoning that you can use with Islam. There's no amount of negotiation. There's no amount of give and take or compromise or tolerance that you can possibly employ that is going to make any difference at all. All these rabbis and bishops and so on, who are so fond of the multicultural outfaith sessions, they're all totally misleading themselves. There's no compromise to be had. Islam demands that you do it their way. It's their way or the highway. And it may, as I say, it may seem shocking, but it's something that works for Islam, and the only thing that's going to stop it is us confronting it and saying, no more. We are not going to stand it anymore. You are going to stop right now, or we're going to kick your ass. And we have to. We have to kick their ass. Metaphorically speaking, I say, Kel. I always throw that in at the end. But yeah, I'll pass the microphone back to you to develop that.
Thanks. thanks, Vito. Is your name Eric?
Oh, I mean, the other thing I was going to say, Kel, just before I pass the microphone back, you were mentioning about mosques. And it's true, if they move into an area, one of the first things they want to do is to build a mosque. Now, you might think, well, of course, everybody needs a place of worship, you know, just like Jews build synagogues and Christians build churches. Well, no, it's completely different. When Muslims build a mosque, it's not a place of worship, it's a command and control center. And they move, it's like a forward operating base in a military operation, and they set it up so that they can use it as a jumping off point for the next offensive against the infidel, against the kuffar. And that's why there should be no more mosques allowed in any Western country, anywhere in any Western country. Mosque building should be absolutely outlawed, and existing mosques, we have to either control very tightly what happens in existing mosques, or we sequestrate them, we confiscate them, we bulldoze them to the ground, and we say to Muslims, if you want to practice Islam in the confines of your own home, in groups of 2, 3, or 4 or whatever, that's up to you, but you get it out of our public space, and you certainly don't have any more mosques, and we'll take the land on which those mosques are built, and we will give it to the community for the good of the community. Now, we've talked about this in the past, and I've suggested one good use be to free up the land for pig races on a Friday afternoon. You know, knock down the mosque, bulldoze it, get rid of all the rubble, and use the land for pig races. And I think that would be an excellent use for the community. That, you know, much better than allowing a command and control center to develop within our communities that Muslims are just going to use to make more Islam. But anyway, that's my view on mosques, and I'll do what I was going to do originally, which was pass the microphone back to you, Kel.
Oh no, Tim, absolutely, you are absolutely on a roll. And the thing I've noticed, I don't know if people notice this in the United States or in Australia or in the UK, but what I've noticed is that when we build communities, we build them along straightaways or freeways, easy access to the big city, to and from work. I noticed that we're seeing a lot of mosques being built in Canada in particular, and that it's easy access from the big city. But what that also means is that there are communities in which they decide that, hey, I like it here, and I'm going to buy a house here. I don't know if you noticed that, Tim. Do they build these things, these monstrosities among freeways and so on and so forth?
Among freeways? I'm just trying to think... I'm just trying to think of an example. I mean, they'll build a mosque wherever they think they can get away with it. I mean, there's no shortage of money that's available from contacts that they have in the Middle East. If somebody wants to build a mosque and says, oh, I need $1 million or something like that, there's always going to be somebody, a sheikh or a prince or something in the Middle East, who's happy to promote Islam and who will funnel the appropriate funds to the Muslims in whichever Western country it is so they can get a mosque built. I mean, they will build wherever they think they can get away with it. We had an example here not very far from Birmingham in a little place called Dudley a few years ago. And it's only a tiny little town, Dudley. It's a bit bigger than a village, but it's only a small town, and they wanted to build what would effectively have been a mega mosque on some land that they had acquired, and it was all set to go ahead. They'd bribed the appropriate people on the planning committees in Dudley, and it looked as if it was all going to go ahead. And then the EDL got wind of this, and they organised several protests, and they raised the profile of the whole thing, which Muslims, of course, were naturally trying to get done very, very quietly. And in the end, the mosque was the planning permission for the mosque was declined, and they to my knowledge they haven't been able to go forward with that. And mosque building needs to be restricted. Well, it has to be absolutely stopped because of the problems that, that we discussed before. But where yeah. do they build? Well, the answer to that is they build wherever they think they can get away with it. I don't know about freeways in particular, but yeah. they will certainly build in the most inappropriate places. I mean, to have a great big mosque in a little town like Dudley was totally out of character. But of course, once the mosque is built, they then say, well, we've got a mosque here, so, you know, let's have loads of houses for Muslims, please, because we've got a big mosque, you know. So
oh, yeah.
They, you know, if they haven't got the Muslims there, they'll build the mosque to attract the Muslims, and then they'll demand all sorts of extra privileges on the back of that. And it's exactly the same story everywhere, which is why I'm so grateful to people like Gavin Bobie of the Law and Freedom Foundation, who's put forward a template to actually put to planning committees if they're ever thinking about granting planning permission for a mosque. And he says it's not just the fact that that there might be parking problems or whatever, it's the fact that it's a public order issue. And if you allow a command and control centre for an alien and hostile ideology to be built in your local area, then the time is going to come when you as planning officers are going to be held responsible for it. And it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be next week, but you will be held responsible. And when planning officers realise the implications of what it might mean if they grant planning permission for a mosque, very quickly they realise that it's perhaps not in their best interest at all. And Gavin Bobie has been wildly successful in his... Mosque Busters, that's it. He's been wildly successful in bringing it home to planning authorities that they really ought not to be granting planning permission for mosques at all, full stop. And we need to certainly turn around the program of mosque building that's going on in the West. We need to completely halt it. And those mosques that are there now, we certainly need to control, if not, well, obviously, if they're preaching sedition and treason and inciting violence to non-Muslims, and that can be proved, then they ought to be shut down and the buildings ought to be confiscated, sequestrated, bulldozed, and the land given over to the wider community. That's what should happen. But actually stopping any more being built right now is actually a good thing. So my hat's off to Gavin Bobie. But that's an aside. I'm digressing a little bit there. But, yeah, mosques, you shouldn't have...
Oh, no, that's absolutely fine. I just want to let you know, though, that once again...
Oh, we're running out of time, aren't we? We're running out of time. Well, I have to say it's been a most entertaining couple of hours. I do hope our listeners have enjoyed listening to us talk about these things, Kel. I've certainly enjoyed talking to you immensely about it, and I'm really looking forward to coming back next week and talking some more with you.
Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, Tim and myself, we co-host on the Red Fox Blogger Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. 8 p.m.
Hey, I love the way you count on your fingers there. You don't trust that old watch I sent you, do you?
I have an abacus I use.
An abacus, yeah. You can't beat the old abacus.
But you could also hear Tim and myself on the Radio Jihad Network Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 p.m. British Summer Time. And tomorrow night on the Radio Jihad Network, our guest is going to be Dr. and Pastor Terry Jones. And just to remind you, our boss is in our chat room, and that's Vito Esposito, and he has a show in 65 minutes on the Radio Jihad Network. So please get over there and take a listen. Well, we're going to see everybody over there. Tim, thank you so very much.
Well, it's my pleasure, Kel, and it was a real pleasure to work with you on the show tonight, and I really enjoyed all the comments in the chat room. Chat room's really been buzzing tonight, loads of people with loads of constructive comments, and I'm so pleased that most of them, well, no, they're all positive comments, and I hope that all our listeners will come home, will come back to us next week for another edition of Red Fox on Monday, Red Fox Radio Whale.
And there you go. Tim, thank you once again. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost. And that mountain is just too high to climb. Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. To give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy. Once your foolish pride, once your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood that create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats gave you the strength of a thousand men. Gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna be alright. Some harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Oh, here's to you, to shine.